Big Country AA Conference, which was held in Abilene, Texas, September 4th, 5th, and 6th, 1987. The speaker this Saturday night is Clancy I. from Los Angeles, California.
My name is Clancy Imislund, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here. I want to thank Joe for that introduction. I think he left out the last two or three sentences because I have a feeling of not being fully requited in that last story, but... Well, he's so big I don't want to say anything and make trouble. But I'm very glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to hear all the commendations for the people. Bill P. with his many years of sobriety, and Evelyn K. with her natal birthday for 70 years, and yesterday and today, Nancy H., Bill P.'s sister, is having her natal B. And another Nancy here from Dallas is having her fifth AA birthday today. And it's just been a wonderful, fun-filled day. And it's just, who cares? I'm very glad to be in Aberdeen. It's interesting, Joe mentioned Chuck. Because I think Chuck gave probably the last major talk or regular talk he ever gave was at this conference a few years ago, right the year before he died. He was very sick, and when I heard he was going to speak down here, I was really quite surprised because he was not doing very well. But he gave an excellent talk. I talked to Evelyn sometime later. She said he just gave a great talk. Everybody thought he gave a great talk, and he talked that year at my birthday, which I guess was the last talk he ever gave, and then he died shortly thereafter. But he was a great giant in his day, and those of you who did not know him missed a great thing. But AA has got a lot of giants in it. Some of them are more obvious than others, but a lot of people have saved a lot of lives who hardly anybody's ever heard of. There's a lot of people who just are good people who give of themselves, and they don't become famous circuit speakers, they don't become famous people, and no one's ever heard of them, they don't become trustees or delegates, and they don't become anything. They just are good Alcoholics Anonymous members. It really is kind of an irony that the people who are really the most well-known in AA are really, it's a kind of a funny thing. If a person were to really be able to practice these principles and do exactly as AA says, you would never hear of them. They'd be low-key, and they'd be anonymous, and they'd be humble, and they'd just be good people. And I think that AA would probably die out soon because it'd be such a low-key, loving thing. What keeps us going are the neurotics saying, "Come on! Follow me! I'll teach you about humility, you son of a bitch!" You know, it's unfair, but that really is true. It's the leaders are... But that's true of everything, of religion, everything else. This has been a good conference. I've enjoyed it. I enjoyed listening to Cease last night. I know that he was at a terrible disadvantage. His garish clothes and his suitcase didn't make it. And he had to look like he had to dress like an American. But it added a little something to his talk. It wasn't... All the sequins on his jacket didn't blind you like they usually do. Something Joe said is that he was kind of tough on Catholics. Well, let me tell you this, Joe. I was raised in a Norwegian Lutheran community, and I was raised, I never talked to Catholics when I was a kid. We fought with them, that's all, back at the church on Sunday morning. But what AA's done for me, today, some of my best friends are priests. Of course, I wouldn't want my daughter to marry one. And I very much enjoyed Phyllis Jean this morning. Those of you who didn't hear Phyllis Jean, missed a treat. She's a sweet, demure. She sounds that way to begin with, you know.
My name is Phyllis Jean. I'm an alcoholic.
And you think, oh, Jesus. But pretty soon you tune in here. I told him, you're going to stick it up here. Well, I said, I'm glad Cecil isn't here. Excellent talk. And then Mary Beth, who gave a fine Al-Anon talk this morning, as I told her before the meeting, intelligent and sensitive and thoughtful and low-key and very enjoyable. And I know tomorrow morning, for those of you who haven't heard Brian, you'll enjoy him very much. He's a kind of a flamboyant guy from North Carolina, and he talks good, and he's a good AA member, and I'm sure you'll all enjoy it. And we had a good afternoon today, sitting in the sun, some of us, and watching the ball games on television and having a good time. And somehow or other, I got thinking today, because in the morning meeting, the way they've got these lights set, God, that's really remarkable how they just illuminate these with a square beam. They really are. If you notice the reflection on the curtain, it isn't a round beam. It's a square beam, which they've done with it. These are all lighting phrases we use. Turn on that. To hell with it. Leave it off. But as I was watching it, the book seemed to glow. The book seemed to jump right out. This is really very tasteful decoration. Much too good for Abilene. Well, I'm much too good for Abilene. And I'm here. But that is really good. And I really was thinking today as I was listening to the speakers this morning and looking at that, I really had kind of a little twinge about how it sounds so corny to say it without 2 hours of preparatory conversation. And I don't have time for that, but it really is true that what an unusually fortunate thing that bemused, obsessed, troubled, semi-goofy guy got a divine inspiration to write a book that he didn't know enough to write, that has changed your life and mine, that changed more lives in the last 50 years than have been changed by all other therapies combined in the last 5,000 years in the treatment of alcoholism. And we happen to be in an era when that's available to us, and this guy wrote it who was erratic and neurotic and surrounded by erratic and neurotic people, most of them who returned to drinking. And he set down a premise that enables you and me to sit in a room tonight. I'll tell you, we sometimes think it's tough. We have to be in AA, or we have to go to AA and go to those meetings. It's just almost hard to remember. I'll bet you there isn't a group in this city tonight who are more relaxed than we are in this room. Feeling more comfortable, feeling more at ease, feeling more that we are surrounded by people we don't have to impress. This is really remarkable, and that's true everywhere. And the sad thing is, you can get caught up in a little trap. Why have I been made an alcoholic? Why have I been singled out to have to go to AA? Why do I have to do those things? Without realizing that these are the very things that people have been trying to get each other to do as long as human beings have lived, since they lived in caves. And we are extremely fortunate, but we are unfortunately all cursed with two lethal diseases. We are alcoholics, but worse than that, we are human beings. And human beings are not always nice people, and sometimes they're ungrateful, and sometimes they're petty, and no matter what it is, sometimes it isn't enough. And unfortunately, no matter how hard you work the program, you can never rise above human being. So the best of us at times are rather rotten pukes. And it's really so sad because we would like to have some of us be perfect and the others try to emulate them. But you don't, because you can't become more than a human being. That's why you can't, you know, when you're kind of new around here, you keep thinking, one of these days I'll get perfect serenity. And you wonder why you never get it. I'll tell you something. As you stay around a while, you discover that I have never seen anyone here who could stand perfect serenity. We're just too erratic for that. You know, you might make a day. Someday you may get about a day and a half of serenity. And it's just wonderful for a while, but and pretty soon your off arm will, without any volition of your own, will just dip into a septic tank and start to stir. Look what attacked me. Because human beings can't take serenity very well. The only ones I've ever seen that maintained any serenity was the electric shock ward over at Big Spring. And some of them were serene for days at a time. Do you remember my name? Could it be pre-shrunk? And so as human beings, plagued by all human beings, and it's the nature of human beings to think somewhere there, they're all having a wonderful time and they're all feeling better than I am. And I'm going to tell you something. I've been around a lot. I don't know any place they're feeling that much better on a continuing basis anywhere. People say, if I could only get to Hollywood and be in movies. I know a lot of people in movies, and they have a terrible life. I mean, moments of elation for about 2% of the time, followed by 98% of insecurity and fear and doubt and wondering and arguing and fighting and seeing who's getting more than they are. There's never any rest. And I know of nothing. Big corporate executives struggling for position, they look great, but they drop dead on a golf course at 45 sometimes, and they have ulcers, and they have terrible times, which indicate great pains. I don't know any place where you have a better chance of finding values that will enable you to be comfortable most of the time more than an Alcoholics Anonymous. I guess you could in church, if you were into church, but churches, again, they have fights over which church is right, which approach is right. And in AA, we have the same fights. Isn't that an amazing thing? Maybe the best thing we'll ever find. And here we have groups fighting other groups and bad-mouthing that group and bad-mouthing this guy and that woman and on, because we're made up of human beings. And somehow, here, despite all that, you and I are lucky enough to be sitting in a place in Abilene tonight, probably the safest place to be in Abilene, surrounded by people like ourselves, on a pathway, if you're new, believe it or not, of finding a way to eventually not feel different anymore as you feel tonight, of being able to read your book, not you people up there, but the ones down here that got their book. Maybe they'll share with you. But I doubt it. But here we are. And isn't it an amazing thing? The biggest battle you and I will ever have is to remember how good it is so we keep doing the things that will enable us to stay here. The greatest enemy you and I will ever have is inside of our own head saying, this isn't enough for you, that you'd be having more fun somewhere else. There's more going on. There's more truth. There's more insights. If you give up AA and get deeper into your mind or make a breakthrough into a religious understanding of it. Yeah. And it just makes you want to puke. It just... Idiots. It's ironic that we are here because we have been driven here by this terminal disease. Last night it was mentioned that there were, or maybe this morning, terminal disease. Someone had a terminal disease and they said they couldn't identify alcoholism as being a terminal disease. They think of cancer as a terminal disease, but not something. Alcoholism is a terminal disease. That's kind of an odd thing. Alcoholism and cancer, really in a very funny way, are two outstanding, probably the leading terminal diseases, and they have exactly the same problem reversed. For example, what makes cancer, I don't want to get off in a long medical discussion, but what makes cancer so malignant, so terrible, is that the body doesn't, it is one of the few things the body does not recognize as an enemy. So it doesn't fight back against it like it does fight back against other things. And so instead of setting up enormous fights against it, it not only doesn't fight, it brings nourishment from other parts of the body to feed it. It really is it's a suicide disease. It is a suicide ailment. The body does not recognize it, does not fight against it till it's way too late. There's no pain of fighting until it's way too late. By the time that comes, by the time you get pain, it's almost over. What makes people survive cancer? Because the brain will fight, override the body. The brain will notice strange phenomena or have a physical examination or something. And the doctor will tell them, boop, you've got a malignancy. Now, what the doctor tells you is pretty brutal sometimes. He may tell you, we'll have to cut off your breast. We may have to remove part of your body because malignancies must be removed or burned out, because if they're left there at all, the body will fan them alive again and bring them new nourishment to commit suicide again. It's the damnedest phenomenon. That's what makes it so difficult. So they cut it out and burn it out. The brain sometimes is troubled. God, I don't want a mastectomy, but I don't want to die either, so I'll take the mastectomy. No, no, no. So cancer is really a suicide terminal illness. The body doesn't recognize it, but the brain fights against it. And as a result of that, in the early stages of cancer detection, chemotherapy and now other things, it's in most cancers, the recovery rate is above 50%. It really is remarkable how well they're doing. Now, alcoholism is another terminal disease, another suicide disease. It's a suicide disease, only just for the opposite reason. In alcoholism, the body recognizes it. The body says, hey, this is bad. The body fights back against the toxicity. The physical brain fights back against the toxicity. We talk about staying drunk all the time. You can't stay drunk all the time because the body fights for survival. It doesn't care what you think. The body wants to survive. So it will remove, when you get sufficiently toxified through induction of alcohol, for example, they'll set up a series of involuntary, physiologically induced reactions to reduce the toxicity through a procedure called reverse peristalsis. We describe that here as puking a great deal. Hardly anybody, when they're puking, ever stops to think, well, I'm inducing a procedure to reverse my high toxicity. Some mornings when you are sick enough, your body will reduce toxicity from both ends at once. Good for your body, bad for your nerves. Because not only you're terribly sick, but you're called upon to make a series of split-second decisions. And every answer must be correct. Isn't it? I don't know why I got off on this, but just indulge me. The band isn't set up yet. I have a few minutes. Incidentally, I'm glad that the dance is not going to be in here tonight. Usually at these Saturday night meetings, they have the dance the same place where the meeting is. And sometimes I talk too long, and it's so embarrassing when I'm giving a spiritual message and I see couples dancing by. But maybe you wonder how they can tell how much you had to drink by blowing up a balloon or by measuring your blood. How can they tell if you're drunk or not? Barry, do you know how they measure that? I'll tell you why. Because the amount of alcohol in the blood has a direct correlation to your motor areas in your brain. Two or three drinks, you get an impairment in your speech. First area of your brain is the motor control. It doesn't mean you can't talk. Most people can't even hear it. Sponsors can hear it on long-distance telephone calls. But most people can't hear it. Yes, you have been drinking, you son of a bitch. And you keep adding the amount of alcohol in your blood little by little, and one by one, the motor areas get affected. It just can be charted and measured on a map. Balance and coordination and so on. When you really get a great deal of alcohol, they get to your vision. You got a lot of alcohol now. But it gets to your vision. It doesn't mean you can't see. It just means that you get a lisp in your triangulation. You overlap a little bit. Which sometimes gets a duo. You know, they always, cartoonists show pictures of drunks seeing four or five of something coming out and saying, which is the real one? You never see that. You see an overlap of two. And that's why most of us have learned to drive using this technique. While those drunken social drinkers are smashing into each other, we are whizzing by. The lesson here is stay off the streets on New Year's Eve. Amateur drunks are ruining it. But you can keep drinking after that. Your body will let you keep drinking. But pretty soon you drink enough and your body will turn you off. So you can't drink anymore. Your body just turns you off. It's called passing out. But it's a turnoff. You know why the body does that? Because the next motor area to be affected is breathing. If it gets there, you'll die. And it won't let you die. It makes you pass out first. The body will keep you alive again and again. That's why when you see in the paper about young kids who drink alcohol and die, it isn't that it burns up their stomach. In the first place, their body isn't prepared, isn't used to it. They drink like a half a quart or something and they die. It gets into their bloodstream. It increases tremendously. By the time they pass out, the alcohol is already in there. It blots out their breathing, their respiration, and they die. Nothing big deal. It's charitable. There's no big magic. Nothing sinister. But the body won't let you die. The body will make you get sober again and again and again. You can't stay drunk. No matter what anybody tells you from a podium, you can't stay drunk 14 straight days and nights in a laboratory. The body will pass out and reject and on and on. Well, what makes it so bad then? Because in alcoholism, the brain says, I don't recognize this as a problem. You must be mistaken, body. I believe we can handle it this time. And so alcoholism and cancer are this two great terminal suicide diseases. In one, the body helps the disease while the brain fights it. In the other one, the body fights the disease while the brain fights it, or the brain helps the illness. But nobody ever knows that and they got it. All these are just kind of funny little facts, trivia, that is fun to talk about sometimes long after you're sober. But the problem is, they are of no value, the knowledge of them is of no value when you need them the most. And that is when you are in pain and agony and feel different and know that that they don't really understand how I feel. I was surprised to learn after I was sober a while that alcohol has a special effect on about 6 or 7% of bodies that it doesn't have on most people. Now I think most of us have heard that. Alcohol has a special effect. The question is, what is that special effect? That's something that's never specified. It's always that alcohol is a special effect. And you hear people say things like, I stayed drunk around the clock 20 years. You think that's the special effect, but that's not possible. You think the special effect is that it makes you crazy? Some people it does, some people it doesn't. You think the special effect is it just makes you do terrible things? Some people it does, some people it doesn't. Everybody can agree there's a special effect, but what that is kind of left in limbo. And it takes a while here to discover what that special effect is. I had that special effect for many, many years and never knew it. And then I went to AA and I heard about the special effect, and I never identified with what I had as the special effect they were talking about. And I almost died. And so it might be worthwhile for me to remember. The first drink of alcohol I held down was in July 8th, 1943, on a ship in Pearl Harbor. And I remember, the reason I remember it, because the next day was my 16th birthday, and I had my first hangover. And I remember that a little bit more, because last July 8th, just a month, a little over a month, 2 months ago, I was talking at the Naval Hospital at Pearl Harbor, by a funny coincidence, just 44 years later. And the next morning when I woke up, I was 60 instead of 16, and I was sober, and I felt better than I had in 1943. But I held down a drink, and it tasted terrible, and I was doing it just because I'd thrown some up, and the guy laughed at me in the ship, and he called me a stupid little punk. I was drinking so I would look like a man. And I drank that slop, and it burned my throat, and it burned my stomach, and stayed there. And I guess I was one of those bodies, I had no idea, that has an almost instant reaction to alcohol, an unusual reaction to alcohol. I didn't know it then, and I didn't know it for years and years. You hear that instant reaction. You hear the reaction again and again in AA. We don't think of it as that, but that's what it is. A few months ago, I was listening to a very, very beautiful movie star, just beautiful. One of the most beautiful women in the world, and talented and desirable and lovely and just... And she was talking about when she was trying to control her drinking, and why she felt she had to drink. Because when she stayed sober, she felt awkward and clumsy and unattractive. And they wanted her to go on camera and be beautiful, and she couldn't because she felt ugly and awkward. But she discovered when she had a few drinks, she could become lovely and attractive. She said, I didn't think of that as a drinking problem. I thought of that as overcoming my awkwardness. I sponsor a fellow, and we just spoke here last year, Keith, used to play center for the San Francisco 49ers, big lump, big dummy, and talked about sitting in the dressing room there and talking to a guard about, I have to block Joe Schmidt in the Detroit Lions tomorrow, with Nitschke or one of those guys, and just can't do it. But when he and one of the guards had a few drinks, they could go out and block that guy, knock him on his can. At least they felt they could. Everybody has this reaction. You don't identify it as a special reaction. It just seems like a kind of a thing to ease off. If I'd have known about that special reaction in 1943, I may have identified it then in my life. Because something remarkable happened that I had no understanding of. I drank so I would look like a man, and instead something different happened. I drank and I felt the way men looked. And I found out years later men don't feel as well as they look. So I was feeling better than they were feeling. And many years later, when I had my last drink, it would depend on how I felt, I suppose. I was much more urbane and suave and slick and sophisticated by that time. And if some person would say to me, "Why do you drink?" if I chose to answer, because I didn't have any front teeth and I was on Skid Row. Listen here. But I might, it would depend on my mood. if I were in the mood of what I had learned in my psychoanalysis years before, I could have explained why I drank. Because I had a very repressed childhood. There was not much, as much love in my home as there should have been. I lived in poverty. There's always been a tremendous battle between my id and my superego because of the psychological scarring I had as a youth. It's just no wonder I drink. Or if I were in one of my moods hearkening back to my when I was deep into metaphysics, I say, well, you probably wouldn't understand this, but I have a being inside my essence which starves to find a like being in the universe. And I've been cursed into a lonely, cold, an absent void in which I am surrounded by wraiths who don't know Essa. Or if I were one of my moods, which is normal, if they said, why do you drink? I'd say, why don't you go screw yourself? Yeah. Why don't you leave me alone? But the one thing I never would have said, because I would have never guessed this in 5,000 years. But when I took my last drink, if a guy would have said to me, why are you taking that drink? I would never even have thought of the correct answer. The correct answer was, as I see it now, I'm trying to feel the way men look. Now, there's nothing wrong with a little pimply-faced 15-year-old puke in Pearl Harbor drinking to feel grown up. But by the time you're getting old and bald and wrinkled, you should start feeling grown up soon. Because if you don't, you're getting over the edge, pal. And somehow there was always in me, and I'm sorry to say there is today, and maybe there is in you, but I know there is in me. There's a part of me that has never gotten any older since I was 15. I'm old and wrinkled and feeble, and I have to be carried from place to place. Not really, but I'm trying to get sympathy. But inside of me, there's a kid that's saying, what's going on? Who are these boobs? Are we looking grown up today? Yeah, it's just a funny feeling. And when I was a boy, I discovered those feelings that I had could be overcome by drinking. It always seemed to me that before I drank and after I drank, and I became a terrible drunk. I just tried to learn to drink little by little because it was good stuff. But my problem has always been, I, as well as I could determine in checking it out, I am too emotional. I am too emotional. I have emotions that most people don't seem to have, or they don't have them at the intensity I have them. I am too, my antenna are too far. I'm too sensitive to things. I pick up on things that I don't want to pick up. I don't want to feel those things. I don't want to feel that sensitivity. I don't want to be sensitive. I don't want to get, that's not a good way to be. I seem to be cursed with a lot of anxiety. I don't, more than other people, at least when they get anxious, they know what the hell they're anxious about. I get anxiety and I don't even know what the hell I'm anxious about. Just, it's almost a relief when something bad happens. You see, oh, that's what it was. Yeah. I saw it coming. I didn't know it. I have feelings of insecurity sometimes that sweep over me from time to time. Just when I should be feeling the best. And traditionally, in the years gone by, I'd overcome that when I feel insecure to get a better job and more money and more prestige and more juice. And then find out that once the novelty of the job wears off, you now feel more insecure. Huh. It's an Al-Anon soul. Down that way, Slim. That is kind of sad. There's a crippled, I guess it's a grasshopper or a beetle here. He dove right in here. Boom. And he's laying here now looking at me. Here, get yourself some medicine. That's the curse of my life. Why should I give a shit about some sick grasshopper? And I do. Well, I have funny feelings of loneliness. I know other people get lonely, but other people's, what cures other people of loneliness doesn't help me. I hear people say, hear my secretary years ago, he's sitting in my office, Tracy Locke in Dallas, and I'd be feeling sick, and she's saying, oh, I was kind of lonely last night, so I called up Florence and we went to the show. I sit there and think, Jesus, I wish I were simple like you, you goofy bitch. I wish I were cursed with intelligence and sensitivity. Because when I get lonely, I get sad. And when I get sad, I get lonely and sad and lonelier and sadder. And it gets to the point where I can't bear to see anybody. I just want to stay in bed and put the covers over my head and just not get up in the morning and just leave me alone. And that's hard to explain to people. You know, what are you doing under your head under the bed? I'm lonely. Well, of course you're lonely, you goof. Sometimes you can just get a hand out of the covers long enough to... The last defiance of a broken spirit. My wife, I did that once, and my wife took my finger and went... She twisted it with love. It's hard to give your finger to religious people. They get so sullen. But the trouble with these feelings and other feelings like them that have always bothered me the most, although I never knew about it at the time, is that they are wimp feelings. I hate wimp feelings. I want to be macho. I've done a lot of things in my life. I've had a lot of barroom fights. I've done a lot of things so that people won't know I'm a wimp. Defenses. So that people wouldn't know what I was really like. And I'll tell you, I went to college, and I knew all about human emotions. After I came to AA, it suddenly dawned on me something I had never even thought about. The things I read about in college and psychology are the things that I thought made me different. I had defenses. So people wouldn't understand how deficient I was. I thought I was the only person who did that. Because other people, you'll discover, appear to be what they seem to be. They are what they are. I'm the only one that has to pretend and put on a new costume for this guy and a different face for that person.
You know, and sometimes you meet five or six in one block. It really is a rapid change.
Hi there.
What are you doing, man?
Oh, shit, I'm...
Oh, yeah, I'm just... Shit, idiot. Just terrible. And I discovered later that they, all humans do that. Those are what they meant about when they talk about defense mechanisms that humans use. All humans have armor up. Over the years, you may cut it down little by little, and in AA, you may find ways to diminish it, but all humans have defenses. And yet, I never knew that. If I knew it, I knew it intellectually. Emotionally, I always felt, I am the only one with these deficiencies. They are being what they are. I am the only one who has to pretend. You discover later that the world is full of these defense mechanisms. And they're not so strange at all. Part of the human condition. Those are the things that enable us not to operate on emotions that would keep us living in caves, hitting each other with clubs. Acting different than we feel sometimes. But they are varied, you know. For example, your common ones are just acting all right. And there's thousands of them. The hip, really hip. Hey, baby. And then you're coming down real good to me, man. Just lay it on me and we're okay. Or the one I used to use when I was younger, the imitation intellectual defense. On what we've been talking about, did you ever read Nietzsche, what he says about that? No, I didn't think you had. Or
I got me a new Harley and I'm gonna drive it up your ass.
All sorts of defense mechanisms so you will not see that I am not as much as I want you to think. And it turns out the great effect, the magic effect of alcohol on alcoholics, the things that make alcoholics an alcoholic, is not jails or what is in hospitals or nut houses. It's that the special effect appears to be alcohol has the power to fill those voids in 6 or 7% of people who drink. They get an unusual effect from alcohol. They get a feeling of a personality change. Now we think, well, everybody gets that. No, they don't. That's not one of the strangest things you have to ever learn. That alcohol doesn't do that for most people. I always thought they didn't drink, it meant they didn't have any holes to fill. That isn't it at all. It doesn't fill the holes. Why drink? It just makes them goofy, dizzy. I know the best example of that is, I've said it before, but years ago when I was 1 year sober, and I had finally got a job, and I was... Now, I'd been a big advertising executive before that, and now I was a year sober, just recently moved out of an abandoned car, got a job wrapping packages in the back of an advertising agency, no front teeth. I had learned to carry my lip like this, though. So a lot of people didn't know I didn't have front teeth. They thought I'd been burned in a fire. And I had had better jobs than my boss and his boss. And here I was, screwed. And one of our accounts was something called Kamchatka Vodka. It was a big vodka, still is in Southern California. And they used the same billboard for 20, 30 years. It just said, vodka is pronounced Kamchatka, with different colors and pictures of bottles. And it was old when I was there, in 1959. And so I came by with my packages one day to the art director, and they were laying out another board. I thought, I'm going to let them know there's a guy back in the production department who's got a keen mind, and beneath his rough veneer is an advertising wizard. So I came by my package. I got kind of an idea for you. How about using this as the copy theme? Kamchatka vodka goes boom. Better than all vodkas anywhere. And they looked at me. I got the same look I've been getting off people for 40 years. Just. And the art director said, is that supposed to be funny? If it is, I don't get the joke. And the copywriter said, you know, you had a bad reputation of being a smart mouth. I don't know if that's supposed to be clever. He said, but if you don't like the way we do things here, why don't you go work someplace where you do like how they do it? Because we really don't need your advice. And they, I don't know anything that ever makes you feel worse than when you feel inadequate to have somebody publicly humiliate you. If I had a gun, I'd have shot him. Now I look for him on the freeways every day. I got a ticket last week using a .45 in a .22 caliber lane. I'm sorry I said that. But anyway, but I was humiliated. I wanted to throw those packages in his face and kill him. That's just what I wanted to do. And you know what kept me from it? I had a sponsor who intimidated me. And I was more afraid of explaining to my sponsor why I did it. And I was just crazed, I'll tell you. That night I saw my sponsor at the meeting. I said, Bob! Shut up, Lee. For Christ's sake, if you can't be a man, try to act like one. Screaming to me. Well, tell me. So I told him this whole story.
I didn't have to use the damn thing. He just humiliated me in public. I'm a year sober. God damn it, I could buy and sell that guy 5 years ago. They're just against me. They're against me, Bob.
He said, now listen. I've been telling you this for a year. Can you get this through your mind? People like that, they're not trying to get you. And when he got upset, he'd wave his finger beneath my nose. And just, it's the only time I ever really missed my front teeth. I just, but I wasn't going to give him the pleasure of gumming it, I'll tell you that. He said, listen, they're not putting you down. They don't know what the hell you're talking about. Can't you understand this? Kamchatka vodka doesn't go boom to those people. To them, it just goes blah, blah. That's why you're in this goddamn meeting and they're not. Oh, I said, I could have told you that. But you might think about that sometimes, newcomers. The next time you're feeling bad and you're sitting around, think, oh, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. Believe me, nobody in this room that's an alcoholic could bear to be a non-alcoholic. Can you think how tough life would have been for all those years? To just like have your back to the wall and the hounds of fate leaping into your throat, ripping and tearing.
Oh, God, I got to have a drink.
And that would go. Blah, blah, blah. No more for me, Jesus. I've got to think this thing out. Is that the way would you want to be? Just think. You and I and 6 or 7% of people have had experience that nobody knows about. They'll never understand. When your back's to the wall and the hounds are ripping at your throat.
Oh, God, I got...
It doesn't go... Blah, blah, blah. It goes... Boom. You with anyone, Grandma? Alcohol, turns out, has the ability to alter my perception of reality, to literally alter my relationship to my environment. And I don't know it, and nobody else knows it. I take it for granted, and they can't understand it. Now you think, well, gee, if a lot of people, how do they drink so long? It doesn't happen with everybody at the same time. Alcoholism seems to affect people the same way that diabetes affects diabetics. Some people have it to begin with. Some people get it after 10 years. The classic age to get diabetes is between 30 and 40, but most people don't. Anytime. Some people drink, for example, for 30 years before they cross that invisible line and start getting an unusual effect from alcohol. And then it all goes to hell. But there's no time. Some people have it from their first drink. Some people drink for years before they get it. That's why we have this unusual dichotomy in AA meetings, where sometimes an old timer will get up and say things like, I drank for 35 years, and look accusingly at some little snot in the front row, as if to say, how can you be an alcoholic, you little snot? I drank longer than you've been alive. What the old guy doesn't realize is the little snot is looking up at him and thinking, you can't be much of an alcoholic if you lasted 35 years, you old son of a bitch. It turns out it isn't how long you drank, it's when it begins to do something for you. Special. And the only thing wrong with that, if it does something for you, little by little, your ability to cope with the voids of reality diminish. You know, there's a lot of conversation about what makes an alcoholic, and studies, and arguments, and debates. If you're new tonight, or if you're not new, think about it. Look around you. What does every alcoholic in this room have in common? Nothing that I can see. Not color, not religion, not age, not what you drank, not what drinking did to you, not how much you drank. There's nothing that these so-called alcoholics have in common. And they don't have it in this room. What is it going to be in the whole country, world of alcoholics? What in the world is it that alcoholics have in common? The closest thing I've ever found, and I believe it to be absolutely true, is in that book. As you stay sober longer, that book gets wiser and wiser. It is a funny book. It isn't worth much for the first year, but it straightens out. After a lot of years, it's pretty good. But the explanation is this. What do we all have in common? We have all been forced by forces beyond our control, what seems to be individual problems that no one understands, into a situation where we must accept the obsessive belief that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. That's from chapter 3. And it says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. I'll say many of us, something over 95%. There are occasional brief recoveries, followed always by still worse relapse, till you reach moments of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And if you somehow survive that, you can start all over again and decide, this time I will control and enjoy it. How can that be? It's impossible. You hear Al-Anons talk watching their loved ones go through this, but alcoholics can't explain why they do it. Why would they do that? Look what it's doing to you. But that is what makes an alcoholic. I must believe I can control and enjoy it, because the absence of it would make life unbearable. That's why. The absence of it would make life unbearable. It's an amazing thing. With all the therapies in the field of alcoholism today, and all the hospitals and counselors and treatment centers and councils, they still think somehow if you get the guy off alcohol, he's going to be all right. Getting off alcohol is no problem. Every alcoholic in the world has been off alcohol again and again and again and again and again. It doesn't matter if you get off at a $10,000 treatment center or in a jail cell. You get to sober exactly the same way. Or laying under a bed, you know, barking and passing ankles, wondering what... No. You get sober. The point is, you got to... When the time is up and you have to leave the treatment center, or you have to get out from under the bed, or you get out of jail, then you're back in a world where you are vulnerable, and pretty soon it gets so bad you can't bear it. And that's why it's important to remember, in case you haven't learned it yet, or if you've been around a while and are starting to forget it, the deadly aspect of alcoholism is the pain of sobriety. It isn't what drinking does to you, because by the time drinking is doing something to you, it's way down the road. Problems from drinking on a continuing basis are like pain and cancer. That's way down the road. The disease has set up when alcohol is effective in removing pain and conflict. Now, that's why big breakthroughs and big understandings and big knowledges can't help you, because it's a built-in condition. And that's why it's amazing that we're staying sober. Because I'll tell you, 60 years ago, now you stop and think about this. 60 years ago, there must have been just about as many alcoholics, there were as many proportionately in the world as there are now. And just think, 60 years ago, there was no place to go. And 50 years ago, there was no place to go in Texas, outside of Akron, Ohio. It's just staggering when you stop and think about it. There was no place to go. We act as though, well, we could always go to AA. There was no place to go. There was no treatment that worked. The best doctor in the world, Dr. Carl Jung, doctor psychiatrist, told Roland in his office, Roland came there with a blank check. Any amount of money were necessary to straighten them out. He said, you are what is known as an alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no answer available to you in the world today. The only thing you have to look forward to is you must keep yourself voluntarily or involuntarily confined, or else live drink intermittently until you go mad or die. That's all there is. Now stop thinking about that tonight. You might feel a little sullen about going here, but just stop thinking, what in the hell would you and I do without AA? What are we missing, for Christ's sake? What is it we're being deprived of by having to come here to do these things? Some illusion that everybody else is out there having fun somewhere. Baloney. They're drinking, hoping they can feel the way we feel. But there is no answer to alcoholism. And that brings us to the last point. I discovered, because I was in and out of AA for 9 years. I had a terrible time in AA. Because I kept thinking, I stopped drinking and it'd get worse. I'm not an alcoholic. And I wound up in terrible places. I wound up in veterans' hospitals. I wound up in jails. I wound up in just a few miles from here, committed for an indefinite period up to the rest of my life in the state hospital at Big Spring. Not as an alcoholic by that time, as a suicide by now. And I just couldn't see what was... Went to AA. I have no answer. No place to go. 12 steps. Very lovely. Very nice, but they have no application of the real world out there. I'm just going crazy. What'll I do? Turn it over. Release it. Troubled with your past? Write it all down on paper. That makes sense, doesn't it?
I almost forgot that.
Read it to some boob. They wanted me to write things down. I wouldn't even tell my psychiatrist. I didn't want to be rejected by him. I always thought if I ever told him how what I really felt, he'd say, "Get out of my office, you sick bastard. Make amends to people who've been screwing me for 30 years. Here's $10 for calling the police on me that time. Hope it wasn't too much bother." But most of all, when I get sober, I become a wimp full of holes. I feel bad. And that's why it's amazing, and we have to keep reinforcing to one another. When you get desperate enough, and if you don't die before then, or get brain damage that keeps you from doing it, you may be driven to take actions and discover the other end of this funny parley. The actions of Alcoholics Anonymous are not designed to make you more and more sober, because that doesn't help. They are designed to little by little to do what alcohol did quickly. To little by little alter my relationship to my environment. To little by little change my perception of reality. So that the same things eventually look different. Now that sounds strange. I'll give you a good example of that. I was in jail in 1950 for a drunken escapade fighting a cop, just briefly. But that night when I was in jail, my son died at home, and my father had to come and tell me about it. And we had a terrible time. The family came, and I was a pariah again, and we finally got that little boy buried in his... at the foot of his grandmother's grave. I couldn't bear to hardly go there, and I stood the other side, and I couldn't get a gravestone because if I just got thinking about it, I was going to kill myself. 13 years later, 1963, 62, I was 4 years sober. I had done enough things and been enough things, so I went back to Wisconsin, picked up my dad, picked up my father-in-law, picked up the nice gravestone I'd read, went down and put on his grave. We all stood around. We felt good. We put on the little gravestone, John Emmisland, felt good, no big deal. And I, every time I'm in Wisconsin now, I go by and dust that off and tell them what's going on and let go with that. Now, that isn't any big deal. But I'll tell you, I have tried to commit suicide at times thinking about that kid in my life. And I have drank over it. I mean, not more than that, but a lot of other things. But what happens is you think nothing, no sobriety will change this, but your perception changes. I can see things. Much of my life has changed. My father, when I got sober, my father and I hadn't talked since the morning he came to tell me my son had died. And I hated him, and he was terribly disappointed in me. And one of the things that about 1960 my sponsor made me do, or 1959 late, Did you have to write a letter of amends to your fathers? Write a letter of amends to him. All he ever did was preach God to me and insist I do more than I could do and then be disappointed in me, make me feel bad, and make me feel like a sinner all the time. And he's a bright man, and I love him, and I hate him. I wouldn't write him a letter. My sponsor said, I guess you must have thought I asked you whether you thought you should. Just write the letter, and then I want to see it before you mail it. Just tell him you're sorry that your drinking has caused heartaches for him. So I sent that letter. I hated it. I felt like I'd sold out. Sold up my pride. I got kind of a waffling letter back from my father. Seemed to me, showed to my sponsor. He said, well, he's reacting better than I thought he would. Write him another letter. Tell him what you're trying to do. And I hated that. Well, make a long story short. By 1962, as I mentioned, my father and I had gotten relatively close. We went down and put a gravestone on my son's grave. And by the late 1960s, my father and I were very close. And my stepmother, his second wife, had died. And he was living alone, and I became his support in his old age and supported him. And he came out to live with us. And I had a close, warm relationship with my father for 15 years before he died. And he and I had a lot of laughs and a lot of grins. And he wound up being one of my best friends in the world. Now, the point of that is not that if you do that, your father will be your best friend. I wouldn't have aimed for that. But it's an amazing thing. The steps are designed to do things that your mind tells you you don't have to do. I wouldn't have ever been close to my father. I might have stayed sober and went to my grave thinking, that old son of a bitch! And I wouldn't have. But I've been deprived of a good feeling toward him. When I go to Wisconsin now, I visit his grave and tell him how things are going. And I don't feel sad about it at all. When he died, he was old and sick. And when he died, I was glad he died because he got relieved and he felt good. And last year, I was sitting with my mother's little casket in the Norwegian Lutheran Church in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, thinking, my little mother, when she died, I was glad she died because she was old and sick. And thinking, isn't that nice? I sat here in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. I told a psychiatrist for a year how I had been repressed by this dreadful church and how it had warped me. And I sit here now with a different perspective. God is here just like he's God in the meetings. The same God. He doesn't wish me evil. Maybe some minister turns the screw once in a while. But that doesn't have to do with anything. What I'm trying to tell you is this. The natural state of sober alcoholism is pain and depression and anxiety. If you feel that, that does not mean your case is different. That means that you are an alcoholic, if alcohol has the power to change that feeling. Stopping drinking, with or without a solemn vow, reading spiritual literature, taking exercises, changing from one brand to another, all of these things have been tried a million times and they don't work. The only thing that has ever worked in the history of mankind is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him diminish his feelings of being different and take certain actions that will alter his perception of reality. It sounds so simple, it's just ridiculous. And yet you and I will have to go to meetings regularly for the rest of our life to reinforce it. Because my mind has a tendency to say, no, it isn't quite like that anymore. You don't need all that now. Maybe you weren't a real alcoholic anyway. You don't, says, return to normal living. It is a normal living, going to meetings where they look at you funny and the newcomers are going to hell. So we have to do now what they did in 1962. 38 huddled around New York looking at the manuscript of that book and what they had to do in 1941 and 1939 down in Houston and Texas when Larry Jewell and Roy Juergen got a little AA going here. What they did in 1939, they got some boobs or wives brought them to an AA meeting in California. And the wives couldn't stay, so the men just sat in the room and, what are we supposed to do? I don't know, read something out of that damn book. And for the first time, they read chapter 5, and that's where the custom comes from. Because they looked up how it works, they read from that, see what would happen. But they guessed right. But the problem has always been the same. What? How to become holy? No. We can become better. Most of us come here with a terrible problem. High moral standards and low moral performance. And you have to raise your moral performance and lower your moral standards. Because my morals are at a limit no living human can reach what I thought all Lutherans were supposed to achieve. My idea of moral standards are eat a package of X-lax, but don't go to the toilet. We improve. We improve, and sometimes the tendency is great for each of us after we've been doing it for a while to want new people to be as far along as we are. And this is going to be, all you got to be is a little further along than you were yesterday or last week maybe. Probably the greatest and most heartening part of the book that you heard read tonight, because it gives failures and sinners and weak people and people who are sometimes secretly wimps a chance. It says, do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we're willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. And sometimes we fall short. And sometimes we don't do as well as we could. But we have to be careful. You don't make up for it by trying to become perfect. You try to do it a little bit better. Because perfectionism is as great an enemy of alcoholism as not trying at all. Perfectionism is what makes people give up. What you do is a series of goals that you can reach. And then you get find yourself in a parade of the largest, just think, in the history of mankind. There are more, think of it this way, there are more alcoholics sober in this room tonight than there may have been in the Midwest in 1935. That's kind of staggering. But sober alcoholics were very rare. You and I have a place to go. There's a program to pursue. There's a power greater than ourselves that as we change becomes more acceptable and more trustworthy to me, and I suppose to you. As we gather together to share our experience, strength, and hope with each other, to help each other understand our common fallibilities, to how to add a little strength. I'm going to tell you something. Making mistakes will never get you drunk. If making mistakes got you drunk, nobody would be sober. I'll tell you what gets you drunk. Not doing the things that keep you sober. It isn't doing bad things. I've seen people who go to meetings who are able to hold up banks in the daytime and stay sober. It isn't really what you call top quality sobriety. But they came right to the AA club and got a guy that has robbed 14 banks And he was a nice guy at night. He brought newcomers to the meetings. And people said, how could he stay sober? Why not? He went to meetings. He worked with newcomers. He did these things. It isn't, I'm sure that isn't, as I said, not top quality sobriety. You always have to... But doing bad things will make you uncomfortable. But what makes you drunk is not doing the things of not being involved with people, of not doing the things that AA says. And the trouble with doing bad things is they make you feel ill at ease, and they pull you back, and you stop doing the good things. But if you keep doing these things, little by little your life gets better, and you squeeze them out. It takes a long time in some people, forever, but at least it gets better. But no one's ever going to become perfect. No one's ever going to become godlike. No one's ever going to become wonderful. But you're going to become comfortable more and more and more. And that's how you measure it. It's nice to be sober a long time. It's nice to have things going for me. It's nice to feel healthy and well. But most importantly, it is nice to know that I am not different. Christ, that took me a long time in sobriety to come to believe that. I operate as though I believed it, but when the day comes that you don't feel different, you have achieved a great, great thing. It may take 20 years, but it's worth every minute of it. And the sad thing is, if I don't take care of myself, if I get too tired or hungry or lonely or cross or guilty, I will feel different again and have to work on it again. Because that's part of being a human being. But I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm glad that my terminal suicide disease was the one it was. I'll tell you, I've had two or three people that I sponsored die of cancer. Long periods. And I spent a lot of time in the cancer ward at UCLA after work and in the mornings. And oh, hideous. And I've often thought of this many times. What would these people do here if I said, hey, pal, would you be willing to go to a meeting every night if I could get rid of your cancer? Man, they would crawl across the floor and lick your shoes and beg you. I think of going to those AIDS wards in Los Angeles, watch these guys dying like skeletons. Say, would you work 12 simple steps on a continuing basis if I could restore your health? Jesus, please, 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 anything. And people like you and me have something equally as deadly. And people say, here's a way out. You say, but you don't understand. My case is different. It's funny, except that 95 out of 100 people like you and me die from it circa this year. Because my case is different and your case is different. That's where we must get together. One talking to another. Not one gambler talking to a narcotic addict. Not one overeater talking to a sex anonymous. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to understand that I am not so different and these steps will make me live again. I'm very happy to be here. And as I don't think I've ever done this, maybe once or twice in Texas, do it tonight to show you there's no hard feelings. Through the grace of God and the power of Alcoholics in my life, Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, it has not been necessary for me to take a drink or a mind-sedating pill since October 31st, 1958. For this, I am very grateful. Thank you.
Well, I have funny feelings of loneliness. I know other people get lonely, but other people's what cures other people of loneliness doesn't help me. I hear people say, my secretary years ago, he'd sit in my office, Tracy Locke in Dallas, and I'd be feeling sick, and she'd say, I was kind of lonely last night, so I called up Florence, and we went to the show. I sit in there and think, Jesus, I wish I were simple like you, you goofy bitch. I wish I were cursed with intelligence and sensitivity. Because when I get lonely, I get sad. And when I get sad, I get lonely and sad and lonelier and sadder. And it gets to the point where I can't bear to see anybody. I just want to stay in bed and put the covers over my head and just not get up in the morning and just leave me alone. And that's hard to explain to people, you know. What are you doing under your head under the bed? I'm lonely. Well, of course you're lonely, you goof. Sometimes you can just get a hand out of the covers long enough to... The last defiance of a broken spirit. My wife, I did that once, and my wife took my finger and went, She twisted it with love. It's hard to give the finger to religious people. They get so sullen. But the trouble with these feelings and other feelings like them that have always bothered me the most, although I never knew about it at the time, is that they are wimp feelings. I hate wimp feelings. I want to be macho. I've done a lot of things in my life. I've had a lot of barroom fights. I've done a lot of things so that people won't know I'm a wimp.